Good evening, everyone, and welcome to this LSE Ideas event on women in diplomacy. My name is Karen Smith, and I'm a professor of international relations here at the LSE, and I'll be chairing this event today. I'm delighted to welcome four distinguished guests who will explore the role of women in diplomacy in the 21st century. They are all four experienced diplomats with a wealth of good ideas and experience to share with us. We will hear from them how the context for women in diplomatic negotiations has changed over the course of their careers, and what they think still needs to be done to improve women's representation in diplomacy. They've all been active in both bilateral and multilateral diplomacy, which might be something that we pick up in the discussion later, the distinctions between them. Between bilateral and multilateral diplomacy. I will now introduce the four speakers in the order in which they're going to speak. So first of all, we have Maria Assunta Achilla Sabatini, a retired ambassador in the Italian diplomatic service. Her diplomatic career began in 1980, and she retired at the end of 2019. Among the positions that she held were ambassador to Hungary and permanent representative of Italy to the United Nations and to the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. Secondly, we have Maud Dromo, who is currently the Deputy Director General in the Department of International Relations and Cooperation in South Africa. Among the positions she has held are head of the Europe and Americas regions from 2020 onwards, and South African ambassador in Madagascar from 2016 to 2019. Thirdly, we have Michaela Muscat-Spach, who is Malta's alternate permanent representative to the International Maritime Organization. During Malta's presidency of the Council of the European Union in 2017, she was responsible for coordinating the external maritime policy negotiations at the IMO, the International Maritime Organization. Michaela is one of the coordinators of Imogender, which aims to achieve gender equality in the maritime field. And finally, but certainly not the least speaker, is Pilar Saborio de Rocafort, who is a retired Costa Rican diplomat and now chair of ORACI, a diplomacy consultancy firm. Among the positions that she held are ambassador to the international organizations in Vienna, to Austria, to the United Kingdom, to Iceland, and to Ireland. And she helped to launch the Gender Champions Initiative Vienna chapter. We have an hour for this discussion. So each speaker is first going to present their views for about 8 to 10 minutes, and then we will open up the floor for Q&A and discussion. If you have a question, you should write it using the Q&A button on Zoom. And please do let us know your name and affiliation. If you want to tweet about the event, the hashtag is #LSEDiplomacy. And just a reminder that this event is being recorded for a podcast that should be available later, technology, of course, permitting. So without further ado, I will hand over now to Maria Assunta Achilla Sabatini. Over to you.
Okay. Sorry, I have to mute. Hello, Karen. Thank you for giving me the floor. Good evening to everyone. I'm sure this is going to be a tremendously interesting and useful session. During my 40 years of work in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, I have experienced a tremendous progress for women in diplomacy. The job was open to women only in 1963 in my country. And although we have gone a long way since then, the result is that nowadays only 25% of diplomats are women in our system. And unfortunately, only 13% of these women achieve top position, which means that the glass ceiling is still there for the development of women's career in diplomacy. Even though I firmly believe that this is a particularly perfect job for women, we have the attitude, the patience, the mediation ability that is needed for negotiations. The progress that I have experienced has been certainly fostered by extremely assertive colleagues who have reached up to the level of Secretary General of the Foreign Office, which is, you know, for us, it's the top position in the administration. The objectives are clear. We want to achieve a 50% presence of women in our diplomatic service. The attention of the administration is very, very high, but it's a bumpy road to the full implementation of these targets. Why? Because of prejudices, as you know, because of discrimination, because of, let's sum up all the problems that we encounter in two categories. First, culture, old cultural problems, attitudes, and the work-family balance that for women remains a key problem. We have developed a number of tools which I would like to share with you because this is maybe useful. We have developed monitoring of young diplomats. We have developed a code, a gender mainstreaming through positive actions plan that is extremely useful to help women join the diplomatic service and advance in the career. But I can assure you that there is nothing that women cannot do within the diplomatic environment, diplomatic service. I can assure you that women, and this is a message for young future, young students and future diplomats, it's an exciting job for women as well. Together with my colleague and friend Pilar, we've been dealing with issues which have for ages been treated as, you know, basically men's area, field of action, space, nuclear issues, ban of nuclear tests, fight against corruption or transnational crime. It is becoming, the multilateral environment is becoming increasingly women friendly. And this is something that I think we should not oversight. I also would like to share with you another idea. The repertoire of prejudices against women in this line of work now includes the reverse discrimination of men who object to us, I mean, women being somehow protected as an endangered species that needs to be somehow helped through the career path. Let's ignore this point of view. I think we have a lot to offer, and it's important to identify ways and means of becoming a strong lobby in a positive way. As I said during our previous discussion before the session started, we need to include men in our debate, and we need to be aware that at international level, it is now considered important to include women and to allow women to participate fully in the entire range of actions that diplomats usually performs. I have colleagues who have worked in a crisis situation, in conflict situations. It can be done. It can be done, but it is still there is still need for initiatives that link women one with another in order to become stronger. If we are united, we are stronger. That's a message I like to share with all of you. And I would also like to add that I am afraid that sometimes structured initiatives tend to have a life of their own and become burdensome. So we have to find very informal ways of reaching out to each other. Certainly, we have the means. And for the moment, I'll stop here. I stand ready to first to be corrected if anybody feels that I said something which is not totally true. Second, I'll be very happy to answer questions from the floor. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Maria. So on to our second speaker, Maud.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and participants and fellow presenters. Good evening. Thank you very much for this opportunity. Not only to participate in this, but for this topic to be chosen as being strategic and critical for foreign policy. I think this is exactly this kind of discussions which raise awareness, educate, and hope to inspire current and future leaders to do better in investing in gender equality as a capital resource and currency. And it's only when we do this that we can transform our communities. How has the context changed during my career? I think I will agree with my earlier participant and colleague about what she said. I believe that progress is being made in involving women in diplomatic negotiations. I'm going to give examples in terms of my experience in peace and security negotiations. I was fortunate enough to have been part of the negotiations between the ruling and majority political parties, where the UN coordinator and the African Union special representative were both women, and they both led the negotiations and played strategic roles during and for the formulation of the transitional government in Madagascar in 2018. However, I believe that a lot has still need to be done because this has not become a generalized norm across the world as yet. And I'll make an example about what we've done during my career when I was responsible for the Diplomatic Academy of our foreign ministry in South Africa. At the time, we established an international school primarily to get diplomats from post-conflict countries to come together to share their experiences, but also to learn the requisite skills for conflict prevention, resolution, and nation building. We encouraged countries to send women diplomats as well, but we could not force them to. As South Africa, we shared our experience of conflict and how we defeated the racist apartheid system during our interactions. However, we were quite ambitious and hoped that more women could be groomed and supported in participating in mediation, facilitation, and in negotiations during conflict at national, regional, and the global levels, particularly the UN. This came about because we realized that there were too few women as special envoys in Africa. When mediators and negotiators were appointed in regional organizations, they were mostly led by either former or current male presidents or vice presidents. And even the support teams were men, including the military officers, although this is slowly changing. But we had the Liberia experience, where during the conflict resolution negotiations, women locked the conference doors where negotiators were involved. And they told them that they could only and lock the doors if they came out with an agreement, a settlement agreement. And from then on, of course, with from that kind of an interaction in Africa, we had our first woman president, Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, who mobilized women and became a president. So we had a successful story to inspire women to play a leadership role in politics and diplomacy. Of course, we could argue whether how diplomatic is it to lock negotiators in the doors and say you don't get out until such time. But we're very pragmatic about these things. In our training program on peace and security, one time, a few women who were there from a few African countries requested that we should establish a women's only program that would include an annual conference through which experienced women diplomats could share their experience and mentor the young. We then realized that to reach a critical mass of these trained women in this area, we need a national instrument and which will force national governments to commit to an action plan to groom and support women. And fortunately, we have the UN Resolution 1325, which deals with the inclusion, support, and protection of women in peace and security activities and forces. We then use also this program, the training program, to start our annual conference for women in peace and security, which included all those trained in mediation and negotiation skills, which still continues today. In terms of content, the program included training in mediation, negotiations, and constitution writing skills. Our vision and aim was to get all trained women into regional organization and UN databases so that it would be available to be included, if not to lead mediation and negotiation teams across the globe. By the time we started the program, we had partnered with countries like Norway, universities, and we're also including civil society women in our programs. We also started working with regional organizations and NGOs in delivering the initial programs with the hope that they will then start including them in their normal programs which we're having. I can make one example where in one of the workshops where we had civil society women, one woman from a very conflict-ridden country came forward and said, we believe that the conflict continues in our country because the wives of the warring leaders are not in where the conflict is. They are in developed countries having a good life, and they only continue interacting with their husbands through emails, and they call them .com women. And that's when then this idea that women need to work together at all levels become very real. It is important that, for instance, from that kind of collaboration, Norway, for instance, one of our critical partners, has been very active in the countries of their own region, like Sweden and Finland, in pushing for what they termed a feminist foreign policy at UN levels. And they also have a program, a conference, where they meet annually. We also use this as one of the institution and a system to also start training young students when they had big protests at university at some point. And women who had trained were there standing by to intervene when required. Of course, since then, we have pushed and with everybody else that the UN should take a decision and a resolution which will make implementation possible of Resolution 1325, so that there were action plans and then the commitment to these resolutions can be measured in relation to what they've achieved. The second example I want to point out is the Me Too movement and the different variations at UN and elsewhere. I believe that there has never been a time in our history that women have spoken out and publicly called for the punishment of powerful men who sexually abused women, girls, and boys in some instances, particularly in the glamorous sector of Hollywood. The point I'm making is that there is already a formidable number of women activists who have played roles which are critical for diplomacy to succeed. It is therefore critical to form the synergies, the links and the networks between different women organizations and capacities, as the earlier speaker also pointed out. The women diplomats get appointed by their governments into the most powerful positions, even if briefly, but they need the information, the know-how and the networks in order to perform some of the duties which are involved in negotiating towards a peaceful and sustainable outcomes. And of course, you could say in climate change, a different outcome, but which also will be positive for our lives as we go forward. We have also seen more women being appointed as foreign ministers, and lately they've become younger and younger, and also in different sectors. It is therefore encouraging to see such improvements, as diplomacy needs a set of generalized knowledge, expertise, and political astuteness and understanding. How do you think we should improve women's representation in diplomacy? Briefly, let me say, firstly, at a local and national level, we should know that stereotypes about women still exist, and earlier speaker spoke about. And sometimes young women are used in men's political games. The culture of belittling women's ideas in some institutions also continue. And we need as leaders, both men and women, to work hard and be forthright in working towards shifting the narrative about women's capabilities. We do have role models everywhere. And I'm now thinking about Chancellor Merkel, the role she played in Germany for so many years during such difficult periods of establishing a united European Union, while immigration for our continents challenged that unity on a daily basis. We still find that women ambassadors tend to be posted to not so important countries. And Prudence Bushnell, an American diplomat, points out in her book that it's a certain type of a woman who gets appointed as a head of mission. It's either she's single, and no children, and older. And we need to change that. There's definitely a need to prepare women, firstly, intentionally recruit young women into diplomacy, provide mentoring, put in place policies and organizational culture that deals with sexual harassment and discriminatory tendencies, teach emotional intelligence and resilience and on how to build and nurture women. Of course, lastly, I believe that at global level, we now have the Generation Equality Forum, and I know Costa Rica is part of the steering committee, and there are serious, ambitious programs which are coming out there, which are based on the principle that we should be bold, they should be transformative and game-changing as we go forward. I will end there, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you. A wealth of good ideas there, and interesting programs to copy or emulate, and certainly a wealth of good advice on what we need to be doing. So next up is Micaela, who is of this. I don't want to call you too young, but it is of a different generation. So it'll be good to hear from you, Micaela.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here with a distinguished panel of experienced female diplomats. And as, in fact, you have pointed out, I am an early to mid-career diplomat. So my experience is a very different one, as we were discussing in the pre-panel debate. And I think my generation is very much aware that we stand on the shoulders of the women who faced a much harder battle than us, because there were even less female diplomats back then into a sea of men. But even over my short career span, which is over the past 6 years, I've seen a marked increase in the female representation. And at the IMO, where I represent Malta, the International Maritime Organization, which is a UN agency, we've used this critical mass to become a strong lobby and to cooperate to drive through our gender equality agenda, but also to make sure that we help each other to each other with the necessary soft tools, especially in particular, because women tend to be excluded from certain networks, especially in former gatherings. And we decided to set up the Imogen Network And it was a collection of female senior ambassadors and also female diplomats who decided to get together after World Maritime Day theme was the theme chosen was the empowerment of women. And we said, we need to do something more to make sure that it's not just tokenism, even though the IMO has done a lot. We need to find a way to make sure that the principles and the ideas that we're talking about and the stories that we're hearing this year continue throughout the organization's work and we maintain this legacy. So we put forward this resolution, which was unanimously supported. And from this resolution, we developed the Imogen Network, which is an end to itself. Because as I said earlier, we realized that there were events that we were informal events that we were not being invited to, not necessarily out of any, I'd like to point out, not necessarily out of any malice. It's just that I guess it's human nature that sometimes we like to socialize with people who are like us. for the listeners who are following and maybe you might be thinking, but why is that important? Why is a network, why are networking events so critical? We found that especially in diplomatic negotiations, you could get a critical advantage. This is either from the gathering of information or perhaps the commencement of soft negotiations or simply the soft acquisition of the acquisition of soft capital that can be helpful later in formal negotiations. Even knowing sometimes who to call, having someone's private phone, all of these little nuances really help in negotiations. And we didn't want to remain excluded. Some of the being aware of how we are in fact indebted to the women who came before us, we are also working on this intergenerational approach. And we've set up a mentoring program for women and girls who are interested in maritime diplomacy. Now, speaking to the point of Maud and Maria Assunta, I do agree that it needs to be a broad church and we can't exclude men from our initiatives because even from a practical standpoint, the majority remain men. So if we do get to a vote or we do need their acquiescence, one cannot, from a practical standpoint, alienate the people you're trying to convince. And in addition to that, I have to say that a lot of male diplomats have been incredible champions and allies of gender equality. And I think that allies play a very important role in this respect. So we also included men in Imogen. However, we only offer the program for women, for female students. And we wanted to offer them the opportunity to have professional role models and also to give them access to networks that they might not necessarily have, because as other speakers mentioned, in fact, the domestic context might vary. So we found this to be a success, and the participants were very pleased to be part of this this exercise. And actually, we found that we've learned a lot, because it's also given us insights into obstacles that the next generation will be facing, and also sometimes increasing awareness on certain aspects or nuances that we might have missed out on, but they might be able to articulate them in a more passionate or strong from a stronger political standpoint.
Great, thank you very much, Micaela. Wonderful to hear the views of a slightly different generation of diplomats coming up in the world of diplomacy. So last but not least, absolutely, is Pilar. Over to you, Pilar.
Thank you so much, Karen. I'm delighted to be with you tonight. And thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this panel. With respect to whether the situation has changed much during my time with respect to women? Well, the short answer is yes. But what I find perhaps more interesting is how and what remains to be done. So I would say that, and obviously, well, I would say that the formal barriers that perhaps were there in the past, women either joining diplomatic services or participating, frankly, often in the political life in general, are gone. And they varied tremendously from country to country. Some countries, as Maria Assunta mentioned earlier, you couldn't join the Italian diplomatic service until 1963. In other countries, if you were part of the foreign service, you had to resign when you got married, and so on. So you had many situations, I would have called the former barriers that were there. Those are largely gone. But what I think is interesting is that what are we going to do about those barriers that are still there, that might not be formal, but they're very much impinge on our decision not only to join the foreign service, but actually to stay in the foreign service. I will talk about those later. I mean, some have been mentioned by my colleagues before. Perhaps what I'll do is I'll recall them. But So, for example, nowadays in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Costa Rica, it's over 52% female. But we've only had one female Minister of Foreign Affairs. We've had a few vice ministers of foreign affairs, but only a single female Minister of Foreign Affairs. So whilst ministries might be 50%, 50-50 in terms of the women in the ministry, that doesn't always translate in women in positions, if you want, of the decision-making positions or positions of power. And that obviously has a cascading effect on what happens perhaps to the younger ones. I think that is important. And as I said, it varies from region to region. I tend to find that in Latin America, in the part of the world I come from, you have many, many female or a strong female presence in diplomatic services. But that is not necessarily the case in other parts of the world. So that changes. What I think, though, is that although governments have made tremendous efforts to correct those imbalances, those efforts are not the same across the board in the world, and that's something to be kept in mind. And the reason why I mention this is because that leads me, if you want, to what do we do about it? And so having, yes, indeed, for example, a network of female diplomats or a space where they can not only, as we say, exchange or learn about best practices, they can also discuss how different ministries approach the very real barriers that are there, the problems that the diplomats face. A diplomatic career is fascinating. I wouldn't change it for anything, but I always say that it's amazing for the diplomat, but it can be rather tough on the family. You see, if you have children, you uproot them from, they get to a country, they get eventually make friends, get used to it. And just as they're enjoying it, then you say to them, okay, pack your bags, we're going back to capital, and then again somewhere else. And it's fascinating, but it's obviously, the children, yes, become parachute children. In other words, you can drop them in any situation. They tend to be very international, but it is difficult. It takes an emotional toll. And then for the partner of the diplomat, it's very hard to progress in your professional career if you're following your partner all the time, unless you are also a diplomat. But then again, another barrier, some countries allow couples to be posted in the same capital, but many countries do not. And so you can do that, for example, sometimes where the example of London, you can be a bilateral ambassador to the United Kingdom, but you can also then only be posted to the IMO. So you would be in different missions if you want. But that's really only available in very few capitals. So that is an issue that if you want of those not so obvious barriers, then diplomatic life, the diplomatic day, the way it's scheduled, you work all day and usually at night you have an event to attend between 6 and 8. You know, some sort of reception and so on. And people tend to think, oh, it's just diplomats having, you know, a glass of wine and socializing. No, these are very important because, as it was mentioned earlier, it allows you to perhaps have a conversation with one of your colleagues away of the very formal environment of a bilateral meeting when it comes to bilateral diplomacy, or certainly the rather charged atmosphere of a multilateral negotiation. So you have to go to these events after you worked all day, you go to these events in the evening. Well, if you have children at home, I don't need to tell, any parent will know that between 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. is what I call rush hour at home. You know, so I know from my own experience what it was like to come home, you know, frankly, very tired at the end of the day, and have my son waiting for me and say, "Mom, I need help with French homework." So it's you know, they, again, it's fascinating for the diplomat, but it does take a toll. And for women in particular, because the roles of particularly at the top of diplomats were very gendered. There were, you know, there was a specter role from the wife of the ambassador of things she needed to do, frankly, which, by the way, was basically having a job, and it was never recognized. You know, the wife of the ambassador wasn't paid for, you know, minding the embassy, making sure that things were working properly, you know, and playing a key supportive role of the ambassador. But female ambassadors don't tend to have wives, they tend to have partners, and they normally even don't have the time to you know, to take on all these tasks that are expected of the partner. So yes, it is demanding. Now, when it comes to what do we do about it? Well, apart from learning from the way one ministry might have approached the family issue, for example, or the role of the partner of the diplomat, do you recognize what they're doing? Do you allow them to go to the same capital and so on? Different approaches, because the approaches vary tremendously, but if we exchange information on what has worked in one place or what works in another, I think that's rather valuable. Now, within the UN system, as you mentioned when you introduced me, I was part of the Gender Champions Initiative, which is an initiative to promote gender parity within the postings at the UN. So, because you have many resolutions, UN resolutions, whether, you know, I mean, General Assembly or even different UN agencies, organizations have them, that recognize the need for a more, you know, equal representation of male and female, which is still the case that unless it's UN Women or let's say the presence in UNDP, many of the agencies, just like Michaela mentioned, are still heavily male in terms of the of those diplomats within the agency. And that's why I joined the Gender Champions Initiative. And I would like to share with you something that we did that actually links to the absolute need to engage men in the discussion. It's you know, it's, I always say gender doesn't include just women. It's about both genders and the interaction. So what we did is we looked at the organization, because it was the Vienna chapter. We looked at the different organizations, UN organizations that were in Vienna. And what we did is we looked at, you know, that what are the jobs and the, if you want, the rank of the job and so on, and how many were, you know, how many women were in each one. And what then we made a concerted effort to lobby our colleagues. So I went around lobbying male colleagues, the truth, because that was really the ones that I had to deal with, to join the initiative. And the initiative forces you to make some pledges that are key. And I'll give you an example. Even as a woman, fully aware, if you want, of gender discrimination, and having been told earlier in my first ambassadorial posting, often, which was bilateral, was like when I introduced myself as the ambassador, and people would always say, oh, so you're the wife of the ambassador, you know? It doesn't happen at the multilateral level, because obviously if you are in within the premises of the UN, it's usually the diplomat that is there. So it's obviously understood that that's the person, the diplomat. But so being, even myself being aware of the issue, we would often, I, for example, when I was asked to be part of a panel, I always, if my PA came to me and said, oh, Ambassador, can you take a part in this panel? The first thing I did is, okay, it's a topic that is important to Costa Rica. Do I have the time? Do I know anything about it? And do I have the time to properly prepare to do it? But the last thing the thing that never crossed my mind is, what is the composition of the panel? Are they all male? Or if it's going to be five people, is it four males and one female? So one of the pledges I made was to only participate if there was a balance. So in other words, it doesn't necessarily come naturally, because we all have learned behaviors, but when we work and we're made aware, we bring it to the front, then things do happen and things do change. So I haven't kept my time, so I don't know if I'm run out of time, so I'll let it be. And thank you so much for having me and for listening to me.
Thank you, Pilar. Lots of good, again, lots of good advice and good initiatives and warning signs and all the rest of it, all wrapped up into these presentations. Thank you all very much. We have had quite a number of very interesting questions come through the Q&A. I'm not sure we're going to be able to address them all. But there is one question, for example, let me just get person who asked it, Joyce Kibet, who is a diplomat from Kenya, which kind of follows up on something you mentioned, Pilar, at the end, and looking at where the women are, at what levels. And she was she just asked whether you all have the impression that women are concentrated in particular thematic areas of diplomacy. In other words, are there more women who work on, women, peace and security would be an obvious one, but are there, beyond that, do you all feel that there are areas that women are concentrating in, or possibly should be concentrating in? I think what I'll do is I'll go backwards. So Pilar, because you're the last one to speak, I'll go with you, and then we'll just go backwards up the alphabet, as it is. Over to you.
Off the top of my head, I would say yes, but in my personal experience, and I'm talking at the multilateral level, no, but that has a lot to do with the sort of, of UN agencies you're dealing with. Maria Assunta and I mean, we were permanent representatives, ambassadors to the International Atomic Energy Agency, not a very female or traditionally female, topic. The UN Office on Drugs and Crime. The UN Office on Outer Space Affairs. So these would not be, if you want, traditional female areas. So no. Now it's interesting that perhaps it'd be interesting to see within the organizations whether they are, in which departments they are. Are they dealing with safety and security? or are they dealing with, I don't know, human resources and so on. So no, but I am aware, however, I do have to give recognition to the institution or the UN organizations that I'm familiar with, that all the directors were making clear efforts to actually bring to fix the disparity and to change that. So there's hope for certainly for the younger generations.
Thank you. Michaela, did you want to come in on this?
Yes, sure. Thank you. So as I mentioned, I'm mainly focused on maritime. So that is traditionally a sector that is incredibly gendered and predominantly associated with men. However, even the sector itself is changing. So when, along with diplomats, delegations will have national experts who come over from home and would be specialized in different technical parts of our work, for example, safety, security, even climate. We're seeing that there's even a shift over there. We're seeing more women representing their countries in sectors and in areas that are traditionally associated with men. What I will add is that this is anecdotal. I've not done a study on this, but I believe that cooperation is really making a difference, and the network again. And why is that? I think that as the network has become stronger, and we're also using the network to give more visibility to diplomats. So this means that member states and delegations indirectly get a lot of visibility and their faces are known. And so this is in the delegation's interest, but also as we're also working together to shape the agenda, and there is another force to be to contend with. I believe that other delegations are also now saying that there's a national interest in including more women in their delegations. Because even though, of course, men are welcome to join our networks, it is always a better look to have, and it is always more intuitive to have women in these in women's networks. So I think that I like to believe that we're seeing a snowballing effect over here, and that this is really helping. And that, yes, slowly but surely, I've asked the IMO for a breakdown of the numbers of the delegates and also the gender, sex and gender. And we've confirmed that over the past 6 years, because that's the only data that's available, we've seen an increase in female diplomats and female representatives. Another thing that I quickly like to plug in, this is the issue of the data gap. So one of the things, in fact, that we're working on is trying to, with women's associations and maritimes and its delegations and with NGOs as well, to try and understand and see what the landscape out there looks like. Because before you start putting across any evidence-based policy, you need to get a sense of what the baseline is here. And we're certain that it's changed a lot over the years, even in predominantly male industries.
Great, thank you. Definitely fill the data gap. Maud, did you want to come in on this, especially from the perspective of a national foreign ministry?
Thank you very much. Not really. I found that the division within the foreign ministry is between the political sections, which is your line function, and the administration or support functions. And you found that in most cases, or in some cases, you'll find women on the support side, whether it's HR, protocol, public diplomacy, those kind of things. And then you'll find that they want to cross over. Perhaps they came in with the knowledge or some qualification in politics, and when they're within the ministry, then they want to cross over. And those who are mostly men who are on the political side try to block them, to say we belong to different sections. But I also wanted to make the point that sometimes you find women, even in the traditionally male-dominated areas, but they have to fight to get their voices heard, to get their ideas taken seriously, compared to men who might be there just because, you know, but the idea comes from a woman and it's better, but it might take a very long time for them to actually recognize it as a is a good idea which needs to be worked with. Thank you.
Thank you. Maria Assunta, would you like to add anything?
Yes, sure. I can offer an example of a colleague of mine who's the head of our cybersecurity department. There are no areas of work in which women cannot perform well. So the key problem here is not to have enough women, but to have in our services enough qualified women who can deal with cybersecurity. Pilar spoke about space. By the way, the UN Office on Outer Space Affairs is headed by a woman scientist. I have been working in the area of economic negotiations, and I also have an answer to the question that I read over the Q&A session about the role of digital means. Can it foster or hamper the role of women? No, I don't think so. We shouldn't create additional problems. This is not a problem. We can use digital means as well as men. And let's not believe that because we are at home, we can work more freely through the web, just in case it's the contrary. Let me add one element. Men, male colleagues are much more aware of the problem they have to solve with women colleagues because of their wives. Their wives do have careers. They are not ready anymore to follow their husband and play the role of the ambassador's wife to which Pilar was referring to. In fact, we also have a language problem in our country because traditionally, you don't have the term in English, but the ambassadress or whatever you want to call her used to be the wife of the ambassador. So for a number of years, I have used the term ambassador to qualify as a title of mine so as not to encourage misunderstandings. But lately, I have written on my card, ambassadress, or whatever you call it, if it exists. So no, this is not a problem. The main problem is the advantage we should offer to women to reconcile work and family life. This is, in my opinion, the basic problem. On culture, we are working. We have introduced a few new rules in our ministry, which are very useful. Whenever a woman diplomat is on maternity leave, now the administration sends a replacement for a few months because, you know, women were always accused of, you know, taking a long leave because of the maternity leave, which, by the way, is another job, but let's not rub it in. So I think there are practical measures that can be adopted in order to help women diplomats overcome these problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, so Maria Assunta was referring to a question that actually comes from a colleague of mine in the International Relations Department, Federica Bicchi, who just asked whether the tools of digital diplomacy are something that could help female diplomats, or is something that, because of the kind of 24/7 kind of understanding, you're always available, might be even more damaging. But I'm aware of the fact. So I'm aware of the fact that we're sort of running out of time, and there are all these wonderful questions. But one question that has come up several times is advice. What advice would you offer to young women who want to enter the diplomatic field? And how should they deal with the sexism that they might encounter along the way? I think what I'll do now, since Maria was the last to speak, I think we'll just go back in the same order. So Maria Assunta, if you would like to start on that, and then we'll go in the other order. So Maria Assunta.
Yes, thank you. Solidarity of other women and of sensitive, sensible men is what we need to face sexual harassment and any other kind of harassment. I think that nowadays in all administrations all over the world, there is a service that deals with this kind of issues, and we should not be afraid of addressing the authorities that are in charge of this issue. Well, we should not be afraid, because we should not give it in, first. Second, as far as now I will stop here. I want to give the floor to other colleagues, but otherwise I don't want to take the floor too long. I leave it to the others. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much. All right, Maud, did you want to come in on this? Advice for women wanting to enter the career?
There's so much, but I would just say one, emotional intelligence. And keeping focused on what you are about and what you are supposed to achieve, but not having that intelligence emotionally, that every time sexism is upon you and you can hear it or you can see it, you find a way of dealing with it, but without putting your emotions and coming across as being very the stereotypes of an angry woman who always misinterpret things. Let me stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. Michaela.
Well, I completely agree with what has just been said. I would add that stereotypes continue to be prevalent. And in fact, one must be careful to not come across as strident, even though a man with a similar disposition might just come across as assertive. And so to that end, I think that we need to be very strategic, more so than men, and that we need to pick our battles. And again, there's strength in numbers. I find that when taking on a more assertive attitude, especially on slightly riskier subjects, when there's cooperation with other women and the shared agenda and shared ideas, you're de-risking your approach as well. Because it's one thing to be standing out and to be singled out, and it's another when there's five delegations and then increasingly 10, 20. I think that it helps to de-risk it by finding member for other diplomats who share your views, your point of view, perhaps, even sometimes when the national interest might slightly differ.
Great, thank you. Pilar.
Yes, advice, and I've been reading the feed. Should they go for it? Absolutely. I mean, it's a rewarding, fascinating career. The advice, I mean, sounds cliche, but work hard, read thoroughly, and when you engage with your colleagues, irrespective of whether they're male or female, and I always saw them as colleagues, try to understand where they're coming from, you know, so you can negotiate better, understand that a negotiation is exactly that, is compromise. So that's where the emotional intelligence comes in. Think of your colleagues as colleagues, treat them with the respect you expect to be treated with. So be very competent and professional.
Summed it up. That's all excellent. We've come to the end of this fascinating discussion, and I think on behalf of LSE Ideas, I think I'd like to hope that this is the beginning, actually, of extended discussions on these kinds of topics, because we've already heard a wealth of experience and a wealth of views and really good advice, frank, sometimes views of what it's like to be a female diplomat today. So I'd like to thank you all very, very much. We hope to do more. Like I said, we hope to do much more on these sorts of topics within LSE Ideas over the coming year or two. So watch this space. But in the meantime, thank you to all of our four speakers for taking the time to speak with us, even though this is in the UK, at least it is in that rush hour at home. So I do very much appreciate you taking the time at the end of the day that is the end of the day in your time frame, to speak with us. Thank you very much, and thank you to the audience for coming along and listening. And I believe that there is in the chat the links to a questionnaire that you could fill out about the event if you are so inclined. So thank you all, everyone, and I have a good evening. Thank you.